When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The History of the World podcast, written and presented by Chris Hasler.
Welcome to the History of the World podcast magazine. Welcome to the History of the World podcast, everybody. This week it's a magazine episode ahead of our episode on the history of Thailand, which is going to be an epic, which I believe we should be able to bring to you next week. So look forward to that, the history of Thailand, a very, very interesting history for that country and many characters and a lot of influence from different peoples and different cultures, different nations. And so it's a fascinating story. I hope you'll enjoy it when it does come. Anyway, this is that time of year, isn't it? It's the end of June. Normally means two things for the History of the World podcast. Firstly, it means that I'm going to the Chalk Valley History Festival, and that will be that's taking place all week, by the way. So even though I'm only going to be there on Thursday and Friday, the festival itself takes place over the course of the whole week right through to next Sunday. But I'm not there in any official capacity. I'm just a visitor like everyone else, and I normally go down every year. If you're in the area, it's in Wiltshire, quite near the city of Salisbury, and if you're in the area, I strongly recommend, if you like history, it really is a very pleasant location. It's somewhere where you can relax, enjoy some history. There's plenty to eat, a lot of market stalls where you can sort of buy stuff, and certainly you can have a beer there as well. And plenty going on. There's plenty going on all the time. So whatever your interest in history is, there's always something going on that should interest you. So if you're in the area, I definitely recommend going down there. There's also a bookshop down there. There's a Waterstones bookshop tent down there, so you can maybe go home with a couple of new books. And then there's specific talks. Like last year, I went and I listened in on a study on the Mongol hordes. So that was very good. And then I ended up buying a book because I knew at some point, and it will be later this year, I'll be presenting episodes on the Mongol invasion. So strongly recommend the Chalk Valley History Festival. And if you're down there either on a Thursday or Friday, let me know so that I can hook up with you and we can share a pint and a chat about history. Anyway, the other thing that happens at this time of year, of course, it's the History of the World podcast's birthday. So 5 years old now. We published our first episode way back on the 24th of June 2018, and in the traditional fashion of the History of the World podcast magazine, we're going to go back now and listen to a little bit of that first episode. And there's one or two talking points which have sort of become quite relevant recently as well. I've had a couple of emails which I'll read out at the end of the broadcast relating to the argument, let's say, about creationism versus evolution. And so where did humans come from? Were we created by God, or did we evolve, or even respectfully, was it something else? I think the debate will always go on. It will always go on. But very interestingly, we did discuss this in our very, very first episode way back in 2018, 5 years ago. So have a listen to this. The modern human being. Did we evolve, or were we created? At the beginning of the podcast, I read how the modern Bible describes the creation of human beings. The belief of this description of human creation by God is called creationism. Creationism used to be the widely accepted reason as to how we are here by those who read and believed the words of the Bible. God created us and put us here to be fruitful and multiply, and we have done just that and become a population of 7.6 billion individuals who colonise most of our planet of residence. The contention arose through waves of support for the scientific theory that God did not create humans on the sixth day, and that human beings evolved from an earlier non-human animal over a large amount of time. Now, I could at this point go straight into a story about Charles Darwin, the English naturalist, who in the 19th century published the most famous book on this very subject of evolution by means of natural selection. He can certainly be described as a figurehead for the evolutionary theory of humans. However, the ancient Greek philosopher called Anaximander stated that he believed that creatures that lived in the sea, such as fish, are ancestral to humans. And Anaximander was alive 2,500 years before Charles Darwin. Later on, and during the medieval period, a celebrated Islamic writer called Al-Jahiz, who lived around 1,200 years ago, recognised how food chains were influential to the creatures who survived, stating how weak animals were devoured by stronger animals, and that mankind was very much a part of this natural struggle. During the Renaissance, various scientists began to publish thoughts about the fact that the universe, the Earth itself, and all life on Earth emerged as the result of natural events, without divine guidance. Regardless of this, still the widely accepted Christian view was the creationist explanation given in the book of Genesis, and therefore any scientific contradiction would just be harebrained and, worse still, completely blasphemous. Creationism and the word of the Bible was starting to be questioned, and this was a huge turning point in how human beings looked at themselves. Charles Darwin. Charles Darwin, the most celebrated individual who championed the evolutionary theory of humans. His theories weren't always quite so celebrated in mainstream society, however. Charles Robert Darwin was born in Shrewsbury, England, in 1809. Charles came from a Unitarian upbringing, which, although was wholly Christian, it challenged the standard belief in the unquestionable word of the Bible. So therefore, it was quite a progressive form of Christianity at the time. He was academically successful, but was exposed to scientific ideas that challenged the typical Christian teachings and beliefs of this time. He studied biological and geological subjects while at school, gaining great expertise across many aspects of these subjects. When Charles Darwin came onto the scientific scene in the 19th century, he was born into a world where the evolutionary discussion had been excited by his own grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, among others. Evolutionary theories were being thrown around already about natural pressures being responsible for physical change, but all of these theories were being tentatively published due to the mainstream Christian creationist beliefs making it a dangerous game to play, challenging the Bible's word. Not all of the scientists could agree on the method of human evolution either. What Charles Darwin did is piece together all of the theories and make sense of it all through his own observations. He pushed the idea of natural conditions forcing the stronger of a species to survive and evolve into a new species, and the weaker animals would disappear into the oblivion of extinction. Darwin's work was so well thought out and demonstrated that it was a dangerous challenge to the creationist view. It was through his book, On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection or the Preservation of Favoured Races in the Struggle for Life, to give it its full title, that Charles Darwin made his impact. The most controversial aspect of Darwin's book was the claim that men descended from monkeys. Although it was not a new concept, Darwin had expressed it in such a way to cause a chasm between those scientists who read sense into it and those creationists who completely dismissed it as rubbish. Such was the excitement caused by this publication that it soon became a subject for the public to seriously consider, whereas previously it was much more of a scientific debate, which was not nearly as seriously thought about by the populace. This is how the phrase Darwinism became common as the way we describe this theory. Those who believed in Darwinist theory began to make it their business to look for the fossils that would prove the theory to be true. And we will meet some of the characters involved in this new branch of science called paleoanthropology in some of our future episodes. The conclusion of one text that I read rather succinctly put it that if it's a question of religion versus science, then the religious position has shifted since Darwin's lifetime, and the scientific position has not. However, to clarify, this podcast is not set up to upset creationist theory, but more to discuss the discoveries that have led us to create a chronological history of human beings. And this podcast will tell that story. The story of our evolution through the evidence of archaeology. So, of course, this podcast really focuses on the scientific story of our evolution. And I think it's very important to point out that myself, I never ever sort of say really what I believe in, because my prevailing thought is that I wasn't there, so I can't tell anyone what happened. I'm as a history podcaster, I'm not someone who's told you what's going on. I'm someone who tells you what others describe as the events that took place that brought us to where we are now. So basically, I'm just telling other people's stories. So anyone that maybe says that this is not, or this is against creationism, of course, scientific theory doesn't support the creationist theory, but of course, we cannot say definitively what is right and what is wrong. We can say what we believe, but certainly I can't tell you what to believe. It's not correct for me to do that because, as I said before, none of us were there. Anyway, interesting to look back. And I did leave the bit about Charles Darwin in there because someone criticised the material of that episode. When I said that people believed that Charles Darwin, or the most controversial thing about Charles Darwin's book was to say that men descended from monkeys. That's now become an urban myth. And the reason why it's become an urban myth is because Charles Darwin didn't say that we descended from monkeys. However, what Charles Darwin did say is that men and certainly chimpanzees or apes had a common ancestor. Now, we understand that if we look back in the lineage of apes, that apes evolved from a similar animal to what monkeys evolved from. So we could, you know, in the eyes of the world, Darwin was saying that we descended from monkeys in the eyes of the world, and it wouldn't strictly be incorrect, but that's not exactly what he said. So it's become an urban myth. So I just want to clear that up, and I think at some point, if this episode is re-recorded, I may elaborate on that point a little bit, just so that it's clear. So yes, interesting to revisit that episode for a couple of reasons. Now, talking of human evolution, of course, this can be spoken of in wider timescales or more narrow timescales. So if we talk about the evolution of the modern human as we know it today, the post-Neolithic revolution human, of course, one of the biggest factors about our evolution was how we learned to write. And of course, writing in its very earliest format could involve impressing figures or shapes into a tablet of clay. But of course, now writing could just be as simple as writing a text message. So let's have a look back 4 years ago when we were actually discussing the story of writing, and then let's have a look at the most modern evolution of writing at the very end of that episode. So we have pretty much covered the major instances of emergence of ancient script and writing. The Latin alphabet, which we are all familiar with today, was not the first known alphabet of Germanic-speaking peoples and Scandinavian peoples. They had already developed an alphabetic system called runes, which were ultimately replaced by the Latin alphabet. The irony being that the runic system evolved from the early alphabets of the Italian peninsula too, so you could argue that runic alphabets were supplanted by a cousin alphabet. To the east of Phoenicia, the Aramaic alphabet had evolved to give us the early forms of the Syriac and Arabian scripts that we know today during the first millennium. The emergence and expansion of Islamic cultures would enable Arabic script to become familiar from the coasts of northwest Africa right across to the Far East and Southeast Asia from its Near Eastern origin. So it is one of the more successful alphabets of the modern world. Much as the Arabic alphabet reached China, it would not replace the Chinese logographic script, which derived from the Oracle Bone script, which we have previously spoken of. This script would evolve and survive to the modern day, but another thing that the Chinese do not get enough credit for is their printing. Now, when we talk about the history of literature and writing, one of the greatest innovations that is on a par with the creation of the internet in modern times was the introduction of the printing press during medieval times. However, this was not the earliest known form of printing by a long way. The first known printing was made using woodblocks, and it was developed in China maybe in around the year 200. Generally, the Chinese would print onto textiles, but they also began to print on paper. Now, paper is also something that, when traced back to its earliest evidence, also points us towards this period of Chinese history. So the Chinese made significant advances in the materials of record keeping. The Chinese would use plant fibres, and through a long process of preparation, straining and compression, they would produce sheets of paper. This style of paper production was much more widely available than papyrus and parchment, and would ultimately become the world's preferred material for writing. It would take its name from papyrus, as it would serve the same practical purpose, even though papyrus is actually the name of the plant from which papyrus is made.
As is the case with Chinese, not every culture has an alphabet. Modern Chinese script has over 3,000 glyphs which make up its modern script. Japanese, however, goes one stage further. Japanese script has been influenced by a variety of local scripts, mainly that of the Chinese script, but through the ages this has resulted in a writing system that contains over 50,000 characters. Now, it is certainly not possible for Japanese script to be fully learned by anyone, but children are encouraged to learn at least a couple of thousand. It also presents a problem in the 21st century world of internet communication, where it has been necessary to promote the use of romanized Japanese, which is Japanese language written with the Latin alphabet. This style of Japanese is called Romaji and is learned in the schools of Japan despite its unusual nature. This will at least make it possible for Japanese conversation to be communicated using a modern computer keyboard. The traditional Japanese script was adapted from Chinese writing from the 5th century. Coming back to Europe, and as we mentioned, alphabets were a difficult thing to control, and when it touched a new society who spoke in a different tongue, they may adopt the alphabet, but then they might change it, either deliberately or inadvertently, over time. Standards were introduced, such as the Carolingian minuscule, which would attempt to standardise the way in which the Latin alphabet was written, which would be very important to maintain its universal integrity. This was especially important as more and more people were encouraged to become literate, especially in the monasteries where they would go to great efforts to illuminate their scriptures with decorative borders and a large decorated capital letter at the start, which would be infused with gold leaf and a variety of coloured dyes in many cases. It was a 9th century Byzantine monk who would create the first Slavic alphabet, simply because the Latin and Greek alphabets did not quite suit the vocal sounds of the language in the central eastern European lands of Moravia. The monk's name was Saint Cyril, and as such, the alphabet is called the Cyrillic alphabet. Still in use today in Russia and many other ex-Soviet Union countries, and also Bulgaria, Serbia, and North Macedonia. Certainly, in the last 600 years, we have seen more advancements with standardised alphabetic glyphs, produced for the purpose of producing printed works through the use of the press, and subsequently, when the typewriter was introduced during the 19th century. Fountain pens would replace quills as the primary writing stylus, and with the introduction of email messaging during the 1970s, we would accelerate into a world of word processors, computer keyboards, and text messaging.
Always fascinating to consider the differences between writing systems around the world, and the fact that the Japanese script is so diverse that it's unlearnable. So a very interesting insight there into global writing styles, languages, alphabets, really enjoyed doing that exploration all that time ago. It seems strange, doesn't it, 4 years ago. Anyway, that was it for that episode. One of the characters that we kept bumping into in our earlier episodes was King Pyrrhus of Epirus. Now, Epirus, sort of similar geographically to where the modern country of Albania is now. Not exactly, but not too dissimilar. And we hear of people, or certainly countries, having Pyrrhic victories. And the Pyrrhic victory has become known to us in the modern day as when you win a battle, but you lose everything in the process of winning it. So you basically, it wasn't worth the victory. You might as well have not taken place in the first place. And the phrase Pyrrhic victory we get directly from this character, King Pyrrhus of Epirus. And 3 years ago, we were talking about Rome and how Rome had expanded from its humble origins around the city to take over the entire Italian peninsula. And King Pyrrhus of Epirus was very much a part of that story. Now, if you're getting a sense of déjà vu at this point, it is probably because we are continuously bumping into King Pyrrhus of Epirus during this podcast. This character was an Epirate king from the land of Epirus on the Balkan Peninsula, and his main legacy to history was that he crossed the Ionian Sea in the 3rd century BCE, made war against the Carthaginians in Sicily, and then against the Romans on the Italian peninsula, scoring some famous victories, but ultimately achieving no lasting result due to the fact that in scoring victory, he lost too much to be able to capitalise and ended up going back across the Ionian Sea, leaving the Romans and the Carthaginians to focus on each other, something we'll pick up on next week. We first spoke of King Pyrrhus from the perspective of the Carthaginians in our episode about Punic culture back in episode 9 of volume 2. We also spoke of him again, but this time from the Greek cultural perspective in episode 17 of this volume. Now we need to talk about him from the Roman perspective. By the year 280 BCE, the Romans had influence over a band of land across the width of the peninsula from Rome in the west to the Adriatic Sea in the east, and they certainly now had to be the most powerful entity of the Italian peninsula. However, the Etruscans were still dominant in the north of the peninsula, and the south was dominated by Greek colonies who were now operating as societies of their own, since their founding Greek societies had undergone major political upheavals following the events of the Macedonian conquest of the 4th century BCE, amongst other things. Sicily was being competed for by the Carthaginians in the west of the island and the Syracusans in the east, and the Romans had a very good diplomatic understanding with the Carthaginians at the time. The Carthaginians were also enjoying a very prosperous phase in their own history. Pyrrhus crossed the Ionian Sea and landed at Tarentum in the south of the Italian peninsula. Tarentum was originally a Spartan colony established in the 8th century BCE, and they were able to maintain a political relationship with the Spartans throughout the centuries following. Tarentum had watched nervously as the Romans increased their influence in the middle of the peninsula, especially at the expense of the Samnites, who were a highly respected buffer between Rome and the south. Some of the Greek colonies of the south were now approaching the Romans, possibly in a similar way to how the Campanians had done in the previous century. Tarentum was the most powerful of the colonies of Magna Graecia, and Tarentum was not happy that the Romans were becoming involved in the affairs of Magna Graecia. Rome continued its involvement in the affairs of Magna Graecia, and when the Roman navy entered the Gulf of Taranto, the Tarentines attacked them, leading to a declaration of war. And this is when Pyrrhus was invited to Tarentum. The Epirates would clash with the Romans at the Battle of Heraclea, and they would defeat the Romans. However, the loss of men in the Epirate army was too high for Pyrrhus to be able to capitalise on, and although the Romans had to retreat, the Epirates would have to rebuild too. Pyrrhus would embark on a campaign of gathering resources, while the Romans would prepare to meet the pirates again. And this would happen the following year when the two parties clashed again at the Battle of Asculum. The pirates would be victorious again, but once again the battle was extremely expensive to both sides. The Romans would once again return to Rome to rebuild, while Pyrrhus turned his attention to doing battle against the Carthaginians in Sicily. Pyrrhus believed that by defeating Carthage, he could capitalize on the resources of the Carthaginian Empire. The Romans were in their homeland, so they were able to pull on the resources of their societies to replenish their forces. Pyrrhus would need to be inventive as his resource pool was somewhat limited, and he would require assistance from other Hellenistic societies and nations to provide and transport more resources to the Italian peninsula. Pyrrhus was quite successful in Sicily, but he was unable to finish off the Carthaginians due to the fact that the native Sicilians were rising up against him and the Romans were ready to come back to the south again. The Epirots would meet the Romans in battle again in 275 BCE, and this time it was the Battle of Beneventum. Just as it was at Heraclea and Asculum, Beneventum was a fierce contest in which both parties suffered many losses, and it is not clear whether either side truly could claim victory. But we do know that Pyrrhus suffered enough losses to have to effectively give up on his campaign. Pyrrhus would return to Epirus, having achieved no gain in the last 5 years. The Carthaginians re-established themselves in Sicily, and the Romans capitalised on the entire situation. The Romans had befriended enough of the societies of Magna Graecia to be able to gain a foothold in the south. And when Pyrrhus of Epirus died on campaign in the Peloponnese, the city of Tarentum knew that the game was up. They had no option but to surrender to the Romans or face complete destruction. With the Etruscans subdued in the north of the peninsula and all of Magna Graecia now subjugated in the south, the Romans were now in control of the Italian peninsula and were now recognised by the known world as an international power. That was 3 years ago in the History of the World podcast's library. And our final journey back in time this week will be to go back 2 years. And what was we talking about 2 years ago? Well, we were actually in Central America, and we were talking about the Mayan societies. And quite interestingly, when we were discussing the early Mayan societies, we're still yet to discuss the later Mayan societies. Of course, that will be later on in Volume 4. But when we were talking about the early Mayan societies, we discussed their calendar and how this traditional ancient calendar had a very profound effect on the world back in 2012. Let's find out why. In our episode on the Zapotecs, which was episode 73, we described their calendar, which was in the form of a 260-day ritual cycle working alongside a 365-day astronomical cycle. These two calendars were also featured in the records of the Maya, but there was also another calendar in operation called the Long Count calendar, whose roots can be found in both the pre-classic Mayan civilization and the Olmec civilization. The Long Count method was used for long-term time periods that could chart time since the creation of the universe, which can interestingly be traced back to the date, the 11th of August, 3114 BCE. So effectively, all counting proceeded from that very date. The creation of the universe followed on from the end of the previous universe, which was actually the third attempt to create a successful universe, which was ultimately not successful. So the fourth universe was created, and we can follow this story in the Popol Vuh. We mentioned the Popol Vuh as the cosmogony script which was depicted in the friezes discovered at the pre-classic site of El Mirador. The hero twins in this story created man from maize in this fourth incarnation of the universe. The calendar is constructed with regard for the dates of the new incarnations, with the fourth incarnation coming at the end of the third incarnation's 13th bacton. A bacton works out to contain a total of 144,000 days, and this is very interesting, because if we were to assume that each universal cycle lasts for a period of 13 bactons, then the last date of the 13th bacton of the fourth incarnation works out to be the 21st of December 2012. This actually created a wave of thought throughout the modern world that there would be an apocalyptic event in 2012, and many of us may even remember this happening. Many news programs were covered a story, and ceremonies took place to mark the end of the world, even at the Mayan city of Tikal itself. However, it was just actually one of those things that was swept along by sensationalists, because there was no evidence to suggest that each universe was born after a 13th bacton cycle, and there was no evidence to suggest that each incarnation would end in an apocalypse. So many scholars dismissed the suggestion of the end of the world, and evidently we are all still here anyway. Interestingly, it seems that the Mayan long count calendar actually fell into disuse after the end of the classic period, with no evidence of its use in the post-classic. The most recent instance of the use of the long count calendar was in the early 10th century at the important Mayan city of Tonina. Thank you very much for listening to this week's episode of the History of the World podcast, which was a History of the World podcast magazine special. And it's always great to look back on some of the stories that we've told in the past and remind ourselves of those stories that maybe we've even forgotten about. It's been so long ago since we published them. So always great to revisit those moments. Also buys me a bit of time while I'm writing these special episodes, with such is the wide scope of the subjects of the special episodes, that it does take me a long time, I think, to research and write them. And the last couple in particular have been very long. They've turned out to be very long episodes. So I thank you all for your patience as ever. Now, if you enjoy the podcast and want to support the podcast, then please visit our website, historyoftheworldpodcast.com. Click on the Patreon link and sign up to make a monthly contribution. When you do that, you will become a lifelong member of the History of the World podcast Illuminati, and you will qualify for various gifts and rewards. And if you want to access bonus material and you want to listen to the podcast ad-free, then subscribe to the podcast on Spotify. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, drop me a line at historyoftheworldpodcast@mail.com.
Listener messages and reviews.
So this week we got a review from Fern Jania F from the United States of America, who's put fantastic, already through volumes 1 to 3. Unbelievably great. I've had this in my ear every moment someone wasn't talking to me or sleeping. Since finding, can't wait to get caught up. What a great review. Thank you very much indeed. Connor Banman wrote in and said, "Hi Chris, I have listened to your podcast for a few months now and have just caught up to current episodes. It's great and I have learnt a lot. As a Bible believer, I take the creation story literally, but that doesn't mean I didn't enjoy your first volume. I believe that we have the same evidence and just come to different conclusions, such as the first civilizations originating around Mesopotamia. I would say that this is due to Noah landing there and the characters from Genesis settling there. You, I assume, maybe I'm wrong, so please correct me if I'm wrong, would believe that the stories come from the fact that the civilizations wrote the stories in the area they lived. Everything you cover, I believe, in just slightly differently. I think it's important to remember we as humans agree on more than we disagree." Certainly, yes, certainly creationism and evolution used to be polar opposites, didn't they? And I don't think they are so much now, Connor. You followed up, actually. You said, "Just after I sent that previous email, I listened to the Byzantine Empire Part 2, where you got an email from Jake White, who is a fellow creation believer. I agree with everything he says about your podcast. I agree with his line of reasoning connecting what other evolutionists believe with the biblical account. I simply disagree with his belief that the first few chapters of Genesis are not literal. I consider myself a part of a group who believes that the Bible is a literary book and consider the days to be 24 hours. I love that there are opinions, however, because that is how we learn." Connor Banman. Thank you very much, Connor. Always going to be a very intense conversation, I think, and one that you should enjoy taking part in, I think, if you do take part in that argument between creationism and evolutionists. But anyway, that's it for this week. Hopefully next week we should get the Thailand episode, although I will be away at the Chalk Valley History Festival. I do believe that I can present that episode to you, so look out for that next week. If you're around at the Chalk Valley History Festival on Thursday and Friday, do hit me up. Anyway, that's it for this week. Thanks very much for listening, and until next time, be good.
The History of the World podcast, written and presented by Chris Hasler. Please consider making a financial contribution by going to the historyoftheworldpodcast.com website and clicking on the Patreon link. Email the show at historyoftheworldpodcast@mail.com. And don't forget to join our social media at Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. See you next time.